It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. The Universities of Wisconsin Board of Regents held a closed meeting last week in which they unanimously voted to fire UW La Crosse Chancellor Joe Gao after discovering that he had been making sexual videos with his wife and posting them to pornographic websites. The news made national headlines and sparked some debates about whether Gao should be fired over legal activities he pursued in his personal time. Gao told the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that his participation in making consensual adult sexual content falls under his First Amendment right to free speech. In just a bit, we'll talk to an employment rights expert about the free speech implications of the story and what can get you fired even when you're off the job. But first, our next guest brings us up to speed on the details of Gao's firing. Kelly Meyerhofer is a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where she covers higher education. I talked to Kelly earlier this afternoon. Now, when this story dropped, from my perspective, it kind of came out of nowhere. It was like, regents are meeting. They may get rid of a chancellor. Then later, a couple hours later, this is last week, we find out it's Joe Gao from UW La Crosse. Can you talk a little bit about just the process of how he got fired, why regents said they did it?
Yeah, it was pretty shocking and a very quick announcement that they were going behind closed doors to discuss terminating a chancellor. I hadn't heard about this. You know, sometimes you kind of hear whispers as a reporter of something, you know, coming down the pike, but I hadn't really heard anything about this and was trying to figure out who it was. The board met behind closed doors for 3 hours and then came out and said the UW La Crosse Chancellor Joe Gao had been fired for abhorrent behavior, reckless behavior. And it turns out that, you know, they had learned that he had posted videos on porn websites that featured him and his wife and sometimes some adult film stars as well.
What has Joe Gao, now you spent a few hours talking to him and his wife, actually, what has he said about those activities and his firing?
Yeah, it's been interesting talking to him. He's raised a lot of free speech issues related to his termination, and also, you know, the board has started, the UW La Crosse has started the review process. He's, you know, set to return to teach as a tenured faculty member, and they are kind of reviewing his tenured status. So they may revoke his tenure, which, you know, would be a big deal and a real test of tenure's limits. So I think that's really the next stage of this story.
Can you talk about Joe Gao's reputation and the job he did over 17 years, I think it was, as a chancellor?
Yeah, it was just like maybe a month shy of 17 years that he's been there since 2007. You know, my perception of him as a leader, he's always been pretty unconventional. You know, he played in bands when he was a young adult and brought that to his leadership role, doing like concerts for students, performing, playing the electric guitar. He's also very open, like with media and talking to reporters. And he said over time, UW system has really become very controlled in their messaging. So he sort of stood out in that regard. But despite being very different from your typical higher education kind of president, UW La Crosse is among the best financially positioned of the 13 universities in the UW system. Enrollment has been very steady. It has, you know, not really dropped dramatically in the way that most other campuses are facing. He pointed out that La Crosse was the only one within the system to avoid furloughs and layoffs when COVID-19 hit. And they have a balanced budget, which quite a few other campuses cannot say that they have at the moment.
Now, this story has gotten some national attention, I think largely because of the prurient side of it. Can you, again, based on the conversation with Joe Gao that you had, can you talk about the kind of online adult videos and books that he and his wife wrote and how he talked about them and presented them as he talked to you?
Yeah, so he and his wife, I mean, this started, you know, close to nearly a decade ago. You know, they were both came from previous marriages, were divorced, met each other and tell me that they were interested in exploring their sexuality more. They bought, you know, a video camera at Best Buy and started recording themselves. Went to some sort of sex conference and learned about, you know, that there's production companies you can hire to film you in a more professional manner. And that company also put them in touch with, adult film stars who have participated in some of their videos.
And the Board of Regents cited, I think, primarily reputational damage to the university system. Have they said much more about, the exact violations and the exact justification for terminating Joe Gao as chancellor, as you mentioned, not as professor?
Yeah, they've talked about how, just having this lifestyle that's become public, it's inconsistent with his role as chancellor. I've reviewed his contract. There's a line in there about how the chancellor may not engage in any activity that may be adverse to the interests of the University of Wisconsin system. So I think that's sort of what they're relying on, that, he's brought negative attention to the university, and because of this, they have the right to fire an at-will appointee.
Kelly, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for bringing us up to date.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
That was Kelly Meyerhofer, higher education reporter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She was with us to take a look behind the headlines at the recent story of UW lacrosse chancellor Joe Gao, who's fired from that position by the Board of Regents last week for making online adult films with his wife. Coming up, a legal expert weighs in on whether Gao's constitutional rights were violated with his firing, what it could mean for his tenure as a professor, and wider issues of off-duty conduct and whether we can be fired for it on the job. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following this story? Do you agree with the Board of Regents' decision to remove Joe Gao as chancellor of UW lacrosse? Or do you think there should be some free speech protections here? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation about the firing of UW lacrosse chancellor Joe Gao, who is removed from his position for creating sexual video content online with his wife. Our next guest specializes in employment issues and what workers can be fired for. Why the list might be longer than you think. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have thoughts on this particular story? Do you think the Board of Regents made the right call here or not? Why or why not? And do you have wider thoughts on how someone's off-duty conduct should or shouldn't impact their continued employment in any organization? Join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or questions. That's 800-642-1234. Louis Maltby is president and founder of the National Work Rights Institute and former director of employment rights for the ACLU. Lou, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob.
Let's start with a particular, and this is kind of a unique case here. As you look at this story here in Wisconsin, what is going through your mind when it comes to workplace rights?
The only reason there's anything to talk about is because he happens to work for the University of Wisconsin. He's a state employee. That vast majority of us who work in the private sector, there's no such thing as freedom of speech. Mm-hmm. If you work for a private corporation, your boss can fire you because he doesn't like the way you part your hair, and there's nothing you can do about it. It's not right, but that's the way it is. If you were a couple of years ago standing on a street corner with a sign for or against the war in Iraq and your boss saw it and didn't like it, don't call your lawyer. Don't call the ACLU because there's nothing illegal about him firing you.
Are there certain union negotiations that might at least hinder a company's ability to fire someone in those circumstances?
Well, lawyers are known for being exceptions, and there are a couple exceptions. There are three. One is, and the best is, if you're in a union, you can't be fired without what's called just cause. And doing something legal in your private life doesn't even come close to meeting that standard. If you're a government employee, you have some rights because the right to freedom of speech comes from the Constitution. It doesn't govern private corporations, but it governs the government, including when the government is acting as an employer. So whether or not he's going to win his case, at least Gao has some right to free speech under the Constitution. And if you happen to live in Colorado, you can't fire people in Colorado for legal off-duty behavior that doesn't affect their job performance because he persuaded the Colorado legislature to say so. But if you live in the other 49 states, that doesn't help you much.
Now, UW System President Jay Rothman said that Gao's conduct, quote, subjected the university to significant reputational harm. If this comes to a court case and the UW System has to back that up, how do we prove reputational harm based on an off-duty activity?
Well, I'm a little sympathetic to the university, to tell you the truth. Mm-hmm. You know, they're a public university. They've got a reputation. But we don't know at this point whether or not the reputation has been hurt. Our applications to come off, our faculty were turning down offers to join the faculty, our alumni donations down. We have no idea. They might be. But at best, the Regents went off half-cocked here. They have absolutely no idea if this has hurt the university. And it might very well not. There was a time when putting sexually explicit video up on the internet was considered pretty shocking, but there's a lot of people doing it today. Some people were still shocked, but many, perhaps most people, aren't shocked at all.
I've seen some arguments that say the Regents were right to remove him as chancellor. As chancellor, you're chancellor 24 hours a day, and you in your actions are representing the university, but raise concerns that there are investigations that might pursue his tenure as a professor. Do you see that as an important distinction?
It is. If he were a professor, there's absolutely no legitimate basis to fire him. Professors are supposed to do thought-provoking things, and thought-provoking is also controversial. If a university professor never does anything controversial, or she is maybe not doing their job very well. And you can't say that a run-of-the-mill professor at a university, especially a big university, is the face of the university. If there's any case to be made for the university, it's because he's chancellor. And if he were Harvey Weinstein, they'd have to fire him because he'd be toxic. But whether or not Professor Gao was toxic or not, we don't know, and neither do they.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Marty is with us in Elkhorn. Marty, hi.
Good afternoon. I'm going to posit that human beings are multifaceted creatures, and what this guy does, how does that affect his job performance? I'm going to posit it's probably all the male board members that are jealous.
I'm not laughing. Marty, thanks a lot for that call. Lou, I mean, there's a distinction here. On the legal side of things, they might have the Regents might have a very valid case here. Our caller making the case that on a practical level, he doesn't see it impacting the job. What do you think?
Well, it certainly doesn't impact his ability to do the job. If it has any impact, it's what constitutional lawyers call a heckler's veto, where people are offended on customers or the public, and they demand that the person be punished. It certainly hasn't affected him doing his job, and apparently he does it quite well. And the thing about this that's particularly alarming is that what you've got is you've got somebody who was fired for doing something perfectly legal in his private life. It's bad enough you can be fired for doing something legal in your private life if you're working in the private sector. But for academics to get fired for doing legal activity in their private life is just anathema to what a university is supposed to be about.
Thanks again.
For God's sake, he wasn't having sex with children. He was having sex with his wife. What's so terrible about that?
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Lou Maltby, president and founder of the National Work Rights Institute, looking at job protections or lack of same for our off-duty behavior. Starting point, UW La Crosse former Chancellor Joe Gao removed from that post after posting sexual videos online. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Jimmy is with us in Valley Junction. Jimmy, hi.
Afternoon, gentlemen. I guess my concern, and you know, in this case, it's porn. So a lot of people, some people are shocked by it, but I'm afraid that the precedent is set. You know, it could be something else, like, you know, like you, maybe you're protesting what's going on in the Middle East right now. And if they think that's embarrassing or offending some of their donors or, you know, or whatever, you know, it just seems like a slippery slope to go on. And I guess my other point is, who would even have known about it if they hadn't fired the guy? And now it's, you know, it's blown up in their face, basically.
Jimmy, thanks a lot for the call. Lou, Jimmy brings up a point that is very active now on university campuses. Can a faculty member or director of a university be fired based on their political opinions on, say, the conflict in the Middle East? We've seen at least some folks leaving posts over arguments over these very issues.
That's a very good point. You can't say anything about Gaza today without offending somebody. And if I were an academic in Wisconsin, at least in Wisconsin, I'd think twice before I said a word about conflict in the Middle East, because I'm going to offend somebody. And if Joe Gao got fired for offending somebody, I could get fired for offending somebody too. What I would say to people who are upset about Joe Gao because they don't like pornography, well, okay, you don't have to like pornography, but there's a lot of things that other people don't like. Something you think is perfectly appropriate will offend somebody else. And if the fact that you're offended, that's not a good enough reason to fire somebody.
Thanks again for that call, Jimmy. Lou, I want to bring up a particular category of public expression. Say, even in a private business, there's an employer and one of their employees is out distributing religious material, you know, Sunday after church, say, or whatever. And it's a religious belief that the employer disagrees with. Is that a form of public expression that would be protected and it would be illegal to fire someone over, even an at-will employee, over that kind of public expression?
It's absolutely true. I mean, American law is pretty simple. Anybody can do anything they want to, anytime they want to, unless there's a law that says that they can't. That's called freedom. That's also the reason employers can fire you without a legitimate reason. But when it comes to employment, Congress has said that certain reasons for discrimination are illegal. Race, gender, religion, national origin, disability, and in some cases, sexual orientation. There are a number of bases, things that somebody could do that someone else might not like, where you are protected, but only if you're being discriminated against because of who you are. If someone just doesn't like what you're doing and it doesn't involve race or gender or religion, then you've got no protection.
Bring on another caller now. Mark is with us in Bloomer. Mark, hi.
So I'm an ordained minister, right? And the United States Supreme Court ruled that as an ordained minister, we do not have the right to file a suit against people for discrimination. I got let go from the church. I was serving the church with distinction. They found my Facebook page. There wasn't pornography there. It was Bugs Bunny cartoons and Mickey Mouse, and they let me go. We live in a strange world where we have to be really careful that people don't find out what we're doing. It was innocent.
Well, it's sad, but it's true. I'm probably the ultimate hands-off parent, but when my kids were getting ready to apply to college, I clamped down and I told my son, get that picture of you drinking a beer in your studio off of that, off of your Facebook page, because some entrance admitters official at a college is going to see it and they won't let you in. And it's crazy, but it was true. And he had to take it down. Now, getting admitted to college is not the same thing as being fired, but it's the same thing. I know people have been fired. Many, many people have been fired or not hired because before you get hired today, your boss will frequently Google you. And if he sees you doing something they don't like, having a gun, protesting against the war, saying something about Gaza, they won't hire you. You really don't even have a right to talk to your friends without risking your job anymore.
Thanks for that call. Now, Lou, you mentioned at the outset, legal protections, especially in the private sector over public expression, are slim to non-existent. I don't get the sense that you necessarily like that state of affairs. What would you like to see change, and what would it take to change it?
What it would take is for half the people in America who think you shouldn't get fired without a legitimate reason to tell their congressman about it. The old comic strip artist Walt Kelly had a slogan that says, "We have met the enemy, and he is us." I worked on Congress for 30-plus years, and when the average member of Congress opens their mail, there is nothing in there about the fact that you can be fired without a legitimate reason, nothing in the mail about you can be fired for exercising what should have been your right to free speech. By our collective silence, we've told Congress we don't care. And that would be the first thing that would have to change.
Lou, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Louis Maltby, president and founder of the National Work Rights Institute, former director of employment rights for the ACLU. Been talking about the news last week that former UW lacrosse chancellor Joe Gao was fired for posting sexual videos online, and wider issues of our free speech and expression and whether we have protections in our workplaces. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. In recent years, there have been major efforts to destigmatize mental illness and improve access to mental health care. Our next guest played a role in improving mental health in Wisconsin by reporting on flaws in the mental health care system in Milwaukee County and beyond. Now, her new memoir reveals her own family's story, including the loss to suicide of two of her siblings, at a time when mental health issues were hidden and conversations about the topic were few and far between. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have an experience with mental illness in your life, in your own family? Is it something you were able to talk about freely, or was it something recently or in the past that you felt like you couldn't talk about? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Meg Kissinger teaches investigative reporting at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. She spent more than two decades reporting at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She's the author of the new book, While You Were Out, An Intimate Portrait of Mental Illness in an Era of Silence. Meg, welcome back to Central Time.
Rob, thanks for having me. Good to be with you.
I've talked to you in the past about your amazing reporting in Milwaukee County. What led you to tell in detail, I think sometimes what must have been for you painful detail, about your own family's stories with mental health?
Right. Well, having spent so many years, well, one informed the other, you know, so it's a little bit of a chicken and egg thing. So did my family's experience cause me to be so interested in the mental health system and writing about it as I did for so long, 35 years really, and traveling all over the place? And I learned in those travels, you know, the sorrow and the heartbreak and the really the trouble that families experience when somebody that they love is struggling with mental illness. And it's something that I knew most intimately in my own family. And so I felt like the time was ripe after having had, you know, what I consider to be a fantastic career. I was very lucky to work at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel with very supportive editors. But I felt like my journalism could only take me so far to really help people feel what that's like to live with somebody, to love somebody who suffers from mental illness. I wanted to turn the notebook on myself and tell the story of what we went through in our family growing up in a time where we didn't talk about the elephant in the room, you know, the illness that was killing some of us.
I want to talk about your first encounter with this silence about mental illness. You were, I'm going to say, 5 years old, correct me if I'm wrong, mm-hmm. and your mom sometimes was not there, and nobody told you why or where she was, what was going on, and what was that experience like for you as a child?
Yeah, so I'm the fourth of eight kids. That was a big pack of us, you know, which was not terribly uncommon in that post-World War II era. So I was born in 1957. And as I said, the middle of eight kids. And the neighborhood that I grew up in Chicago, was just loaded with families of the same kind of deal, you know, families of six, seven, eight or nine kids. And so it was just, you know, we ran amok. It was just, you know, a wild scene. But mothers were just cranking out those babies right and left. And especially when you're, as our family is, Irish Catholic, you know, you were very encouraged to fill up those pews. And so my mother would often go off and have another baby, but sometimes she would be gone and there would be no new baby. She would just be gone. And I mentioned in the book early on about how when I was in first grade and I came downstairs, or just beginning first grade, and I came downstairs for breakfast and my mother was missing and I didn't know where she was. And I would later learn that she was being hospitalized for anxiety and depression. But those were words that I didn't know. Those were words that we didn't utter. She needed to be away. And so that left a big question mark in my brain. Why would she need to go away? And, you know, further still, what did I do to cause that? So there were a lot of unanswered questions, and that really established the tone in our family.
And you and many of your siblings at some point in your teen years especially started to experience anxiety or other mental health concerns. Did you feel like any of you had the tools to talk about that, to tell your parents or talk to each other about it?
Yeah, certainly not, unfortunately. And I want to say that, you know, my mom and dad were wonderful, warm, mm-hmm. loving people. You know,
so I liked them reading your book, by the way.
Pardon me?
I liked them reading your book, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
That really shined
through.
They
were delightful. You know, really funny, smart, very caring, just good people. And they very much wanted to have a bunch of kids. I mean, that was not an unintentional decision. You know, we presented them with great challenges. But anyway, I mentioned that all that to say that it wasn't like I was raised by these tyrants and we were on, you know, it didn't feel very sweltering emotionally to us at the time. You know, looking back on my childhood, I consider it to have been quite happy. You know, there was lots of love. We were fortunate that my dad had a good job. So we had the privilege of a lot of material possessions. We went on rollicking family ski trips, and there was a lot of affection in our family, but we didn't have the tools to talk about the illnesses that many of us struggled with, namely depression, anxiety, and in the case of a few of my siblings, pretty pronounced and severe mental illness. We just didn't have the words to talk about that. Also, in that era, the schools were not equipped. You know, I went to a Catholic school. There were 50 children in my first grade class. So there were two classes of 50, so 100 kids in first grade, and two really kind of rickety old nuns overseeing us. So we weren't having our emotional needs monitored or tended to. And then at home, you know, there was just a lot of chaos. There was laundry and dishes and food and, you know, lots of things to do. So we weren't taking the time, and we didn't even know how to talk about our feelings and what was happening and our fears, and that, you know, ended up not serving us very well.
Meg Kissinger is with us, longtime reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Her new book is called While You Were Out, An Intimate Family Portrait of Mental Illness in an Era of Silence. You could join in if you have a family experience to share or a question for Meg at 800-642-1234. Meg, your sister Nancy, one of the most painful stories in the book. Can you tell us a little bit about Nancy?
Sure. So Nancy was 4 years older than I and a beauty. You know, she was very bright, a whiz at the piano. But it was very clear early on that Nancy struggled with her mental health. So that looked like a little kid who got into trouble in school a lot. She had, you know, what the nuns would say, ants in her pants. And then as she got older, you know, those issues became more pronounced. So shoplifting, drinking, ultimately street drugs, very erratic behavior, and just a challenge, you know, a challenge to live with. And my mom and dad really struggled with how to handle her. And they, as I mentioned, they had had the means at one point, you know, to be able to afford pretty good psychiatric care. So she did see a psychiatrist, and then ultimately she was hospitalized. Nancy tried to kill herself many times. And it started out with swallowing aspirin or something like that, sleeping pills, whatever she could kind of get her hands on. And then the older she got, the more serious those suicide attempts became. And by the end of her life, she ended up dying when she was 24. She was really, those last few years of her life were agony for her. And I'm so sad to say it like that. You know, she had so many gifts, and she was, as I said, you know, a funny, just lovely person, but she suffered so much. And so despite our best efforts, you know, despite all the attention and all the best care that my parents could offer her, she ended up taking her own life. She died, as I said, when she was 24. So that was a real, real sorrow for us. But again, in keeping with the culture of silence, you know, we just really didn't process her death. So she died on a Friday night. Her wake was on Sunday. Her funeral was on Monday. And by Tuesday, we were all back doing whatever it was that we were doing in the summer of 1978. So in my case, it was working downtown Chicago before my senior year of college. And we all went into our separate corners and just kind of marched on and never really took the time to sit with one another and to have these deep conversations about what her death meant to us and how that impacted all of us and what worries we have about our own health. So I'm sorry for all those lost opportunities to have those kinds of conversations, because they're very important to have.
We're talking to former Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter Meg Kissinger about her new memoir, While You Were Out, An Intimate Family Portrait of Mental Illness in an Era of Silence. I'll give a different phone number than usual. If you are having thoughts of suicide or concerned about a loved one, the helpline is 988. Again, that Suicide and Crisis Lifeline number, 988. If you have thoughts to share with us on the show, maybe an experience, have you seen a greater willingness to talk about mental illness in the United States? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Milwaukee Journal Sentinel longtime reporter Meg Kissinger. Her new memoir is called While You Were Out, An Intimate Family Portrait of Mental Illness in an Era of Silence. Meg, we just heard about your loss of your sister, Nancy. Then some years later, another sibling, Danny. Can you share his story and what you and your family went through?
Sure. So Danny was the second youngest in our tribe of eight kids. And he too was quite an engaging character, funny, handsome, a rascal, you know, but good fun. But Danny was greatly impacted, as we all were, by Nancy's death. But I think really in some ways, maybe more than most of us, he was a kid. He was going to a sophomore year of high school when Nancy died. And I think her, you know, our inability to really process her death and speak about it in fuller ways really left a hole in Danny that was really never repaired. So just backing up a tad, The night that Nancy died, my dad gathered us all into the living room and told us, you know, in really no uncertain terms, that if anybody asks, this was an accident. Mm-hmm. And the reason he said that, Rob, was that he was afraid that Nancy wouldn't be able to have we wouldn't be able to have a funeral mass, that she wouldn't be able to have a proper Catholic burial, because in the eyes of the Catholic Church, suicide is a mortal sin. And so you were not to be buried in holy ground. So my dad was really afraid that that was going to happen. But the message was transmitted in such a way that it really made us fearful. And I think for all of us, but maybe even Danny especially, just the whole idea that that was something to hide became something scary. And so I think when Danny's own feelings of anxiety and depression began to burgeon later in life, he didn't have a good way to learn to cope with that. He ran into some legal trouble. He had caused some legal trouble that he could never really pull himself out of. And so he grew increasingly more depressed and ill and really distanced himself from the family. And even though, again, we tried to swarm him with as much support as we could, Danny ended up also taking his own life. So Danny died in 1997. He was 34 years old. And that just felt like if Nancy's death was, you know, a wallop, it was multiplied just 100-fold when Danny died. That felt really scary to us, because to lose two people to suicide in the family just seemed almost impossible. Like, why couldn't we have seen this coming? And what could we have done to make sure that that didn't happen again? So these are the kinds of questions that I interrogate myself and our family. And in the book, I go back and go back over those days and retrace those steps, not to wallow in it, mm-hmm. but to take away some lessons that maybe can help other people and see how important it is for us to have these conversations and to really try and understand them more fully so that we can support one another.
Another sibling, and this might point towards some of the lessons. I think this was Jake, your brother, had struggled with serious mental illness, but he seems like he was willing and able to reach out for help, and you and others responded. Can you talk about his story a little bit?
Sure. So Jake is my older brother, and oh man, I wish everybody could meet my brother Jake. He is a hero. So Jake struggles with lifetime, really crushing depression. So what that looks like for him is he has a hard time sometimes even getting his head off the pillow. So he too is very bright. He was an Eagle Scout. He's about as kind as they come. You know, he's willing to help anybody in any way, just very generous. But as his mental illness began to present, also when he was in high school, and when he went off to college, he really struggled and fell into a big black hole and ended up dropping out of college. But Jake, for some reason, has really learned the fine art of asking for help. And I think we put so much emphasis in our society on giving help, which is great. We all need to help one another for sure. But I really think an underdeveloped skill is the ability to ask for help. And that's what Jake really, to me, excels at. He's great at identifying when he's in need of something, some support from us, and he'll reach out, not in a needy or not in a obnoxious way, but just in a, as I said, kind of in a generous way, just to say, I'm struggling, can you help me? And then he'll always follow it up by, how are you doing and what can I do for you? So he models that relationship of give and take. And Jake lives in a group home in Skokie, Illinois, just outside of Chicago. He lives there by choice. He's had the opportunity many times over the years to live on his own. But Jake really likes living in a group setting, having grown up in a big family. That's the world that he knows, and it's one that he enjoys. And so he models for us, as I said, that ability to look out for one another.
Talking to Meg Kissinger about her new book, While You Were Out, An Intimate Family Portrait of Mental Illness in an Era of Silence. Meg, I called your book a memoir earlier, but it's a little different because you're a journalist and you reported out your own family story and interviewed family members. What What was that like for you and your family members to dig through this and rebuild this story?
Yeah, that was intense. Well, first of all props to my brothers and sisters. I say the very first sentence of the book, you know, says that if any one of them pulled a stunt like this, you know, I might hire a lawyer and file a restraining order. But I was teasing, but they are just generous beyond description. So, you know, we're now all in our 60s. My older sister's seven, and she's 71 now, I guess. So we're getting up there, and we have some wisdom to impart. And I just knew that our family story, you know, could help people. And so I approached each of them and said, what do you think? You know, what do you think if I go back and get these medical records and look at where we failed, where our family fell short in helping one another, where, you know, where other institutions fell short too, you know, the Catholic Church and not ministering to us in the way that we needed, in the schools, you know, in the health system itself, in bleeding my parents dry financially by not providing insurance in the same way that you would somebody with cancer or heart disease. So I wanted to go back as a journalist and really give that full-throated treatment. But in order to do so, I wanted their approval because I love them very much. And we've already been through a lot of trauma. And I didn't want to just do this as an exercise and, you know, re-traumatizing. It had to mean something. It had to have value for the readers to know this is how it happened for us. It doesn't have to happen like that for you. And these are the lessons that we've learned. And here's how we're helping each other now. You know, we're a hilarious, loving, wonderful family. And that's reflected in how we treat each other now.
And Meg, in our last few moments, if someone's listening saying, this is my family right now, and I don't know what to say or how to talk about it, can you leave them with a bit of advice?
Sure. Find that courage to have those conversations happen. Let somebody who is struggling and is maybe thinking about hurting themselves or taking their own life, don't hurry them through that conversation. Sit with them, not in judgment, but sit with them as somebody who you love and give them that opportunity to speak their piece and to be heard, and offer to go with them to the doctor, to the hospital, to stay with them until they feel like they're safe. You know, let them recognize their humanity. And we all struggle. We all go through difficult times in life, and we all need somebody to be at our side from time to time. And so, you know, find that in those people that you love.
Meg, thanks again for joining us today.
Sure. Thanks for having me, Rob.
That's Meg Kissinger, longtime Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter. Her new book is called While You Were Out, An Intimate Family Portrait of Mental Illness and an Era of Silence. Again, if you or someone you know is struggling or in crisis, there is help available. You can call or text 988. Again, call or text 988 or chat online at 988lifeline.org.